Looking for a fun way to win 25 times your money this football and basketball season? Test your skills on Prize Picks, the most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. Just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projection for a wide variety of stats, and place your entry. It's as easy as that. If you have the skills, you can turn $10 into $250 with just a few taps. Easy gameplay, quick withdrawals, and injury insurance on your picks are what make Prize Picks the number one daily fantasy sports app. Ready to test your skills? Join the Prize Picks community of more than 7 million players who have already signed up. Right now, Prize Picks will match your first deposit up to $100. Just visit prizepicks.com/play100 and use code play100. That's code play100 at prizepicks.com/play100 for a first deposit match up to $100. Prize Picks, daily fantasy sports made easy.
This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to episode 12 of the Footmarks podcast, or aka the Stuart Broad episode. I'm your host, Behram Kazi, and you can find me at Def Mango on Twitter. And with me, of course, is Jared Kimber. And before I start this podcast, I'm just going to switch the bails in honor of Brody. Yeah, for luck, of course. So, Jared, Stuart Broad has hung up his boots after 167 test matches, which is quite a lot, 604 wickets to his name, along with 3,662 runs, which is a fair bit as well. He's given us many memorable moments in his career, both on and off the field. The 8-4 versus Australia at Trent Bridge comes to mind. The 169 with the bat versus Pakistan in 2010 comes to mind. And then, of course, you know, there are many more spells. And, of course, all those Nighthawk memories, you know, recency bias coming in, but him coming up the order as night watchman and whacking one for six, or at least attempting to. But you'd have to say that as brilliant as Stuart Broad was, he wasn't the best bowler of his generation, let alone his own team. He used to play with Jimmy Anderson, right? So what do you make of Stuart Broad's career?
So I put this video up and I kind of knew what would happen straight away, which was that a lot of people were like, he took 604 wickets. Like, he's automatically a great bowler from that perspective. And I kind of understand the overall thinking about that. But when you actually start to break it down, right, like, and you look at the greatest bowlers of all time, a lot of them don't have 604 wickets. They don't have anywhere near that. But it's not that any of us are thinking that they're not automatically great bowlers, right? So there are bowlers with 250 and 350 and 400 wickets who are great. And with all due respect to, and I think Harbhajan Singh is my go-to here. This isn't a slight on Harbhajan Singh because I thought he was a fantastic bowler. But if you're saying that Stuart Broad took, you know, all these wickets and that makes him an automatic great, do you not also have to put Harbhajan Singh in that? And I haven't heard too many England fans over the years telling me that Harbhajan Singh is a great, right? A lot of them think he's really good. A lot of them think he's an Indian great. But if we're talking all-time greatest bowlers, I don't think Harbhajan Singh is in that list. And also, if you're coming to this, and this goes to anyone listening to this podcast or watching this video or, you know, reading our Braille version, or whatever version we have out there, if you're coming here and you automatically think that Stuart Broad is a great and you can't look at his, you know, his career, then you're coming to the wrong spot, right? Like, that's not what I'm about. I want to stretch it and twist it and bend it as much as possible, because I think that Stuart Broad had a fascinating career, and I think there are certainly parts of his career that were what would you say, that were absolutely some of the most memorable moments of all time. But I also remember that, you know, Harbhajan Singh, when he retired, probably was what, the top 10 wicket taker of all time. Nathan Lyon is going to retire as probably a top 10 wicket taker of all time. Does that make those two guys great? Right, I would argue that that Graham Swan has as good a case as the other guys. It's just that he was picked late, and then his arm fell apart. That's what I wanted to do with Stuart Broad, because I think you can't. What generally happens is you have the people on one side going 604 wickets, he has to be an all time great. You have the people on the other side go, whoa. He averaged about 28, and he bowled in English conditions his whole life. What are we even talking about? There's a lot of stuff to unpack in the middle.
Yeah, and we're going to dive deep into all of that stuff of basically judging whether Stuart Broad was an all-time great or not. And you mentioned him, called him the Grand Wizard of Cricket Memes in your piece. Now, I know you didn't allude to any of that stuff in your piece, but for the sake of this podcast, you know, just at the start, what is your favorite Broad moment throughout the years? Is it the edge that he never walked after? Is it the time he broke Zulkarnain's bones, or is it the shoe? Is it like, what is it? Because he's had so many.
Now, my all-time favorite. So this last video is like 20 minutes long, right? The one that we did. So it's quite long for us. But I think I did like a 35 or 40 minute series on Stuart Broad's nonsense, which just tells you how ridiculous he is as a cricket figure, modern cricket figure. And in it, I remembered one story. I had to go and look it up to make sure that, like, it was one of those things that it's probably in one of my old notebooks, right? And I had to go look it up. But it's a story when they were trying to bat out a draw against Sri Lanka at home. So they should have won the first test at Lord's against Sri Lanka. And I think, you know, Sri Lanka managed to block out the draw and off the, you know, 8 wickets down. No, it might have been 9 wickets down. Mm-hmm. And they got home. And then the next test, England were doing the exact same thing. It was one of the most fascinating test series I've ever seen in my life. It just was a bizarre moment. And Broad came out to bat, and I want to say it was in the last session, came out to bat just before a drinks break. They called a drinks break, and I reckon he'd been batting for 4 to 5 minutes at this point, and he went off at the drinks break to go to the toilet. That is commitment to the bit. And I've said this before, he was brilliant at memes and everything else and understanding the internet culture and being part of the narrative a little bit of himself, but he was absolutely his best at just time wasting. His ability to time waste in that sort of English elitist way of, what do you mean? Of course I need to go to the toilet. Like, how dare you even ask if I need to go to the toilet? You know, it was absolutely brilliant in that sort of situation. And that was always my favorite, going to the toilet 5 minutes into your innings because, you know, it might save you an over later on. I mean, what a genius.
Yeah, absolutely. I think my personal favorite, something which is quite recent, is when he kept talking to Alex Carey behind the stumps of whether he was in his crease or not. I like that tongue-in-cheek humor. But anyway, you mentioned three things that make Broad great: his longevity, his counting stats, and the spree that he goes on every now and then, taking wickets in clusters. He's had a penchant for that. And you described that as an orgy of wickets in your piece. There are quite a few instances over there, right? Trent Bridge versus India in 2011, he took 5 for 5, pretty much ended the series over there. Similarly, in 2014 versus New Zealand, the Kiwis needed 239. Broad took a 7 for, they were rolled over for 68. He had 6 for 17 versus South Africa. And of course, all those Ashes performances versus the Australians, with Trent Bridge, of course, that 8 for right up there. So this does definitely make Broad a unique sort of cricketer. The fact that he has this ability to come and just wreck other teams apart, not like so frequently, but when he does, he has that habit of not just killing a test, but the entire series.
Yeah, it's so dramatic, I think, when he takes wickets. So I wonder how much he's got a reputation of this because he's played so many test matches. And we have seen, I don't know what it was, 6 or 7 major occurrences, but there's lots of minor occurrences as well that have happened over the years where he's taken 3 or 4 wickets in just the space of, you know, a couple of minutes, and suddenly the game feels completely different.
Yeah.
And I did wonder that, but then I sort of started to look into it and I thought, well, I think the narrative is always a big game player and he's a big moment player. But if you're an England test player, you play in a lot of big test matches and a lot of important test matches, and a lot of them he was crap in, right? That's not slandering him. Of course he was. He played 164 matches. And we saw him bottle 2 games against the Netherlands, right? We saw him against, you know, Yuvraj Singh and against Jasprit Bumrah. He panicked as much as anyone did. I mean, the over against the Netherlands is, I mean, I could, someone took
there was a run out opportunity over there as well, right?
There was about 5. Right, it was a remarkable. There was the full game was on Facebook, and someone took it down. And it's such a shame because it is worth watching that last over because he bowls like someone who's completely on top of his game, and he fields like someone who has never fielded before in cricket. It is such a remarkable thing, and so we know that he's not always on top, right? That he's not this big game performer that everyone likes. So why does he go on these sprees? And especially because the majority of his career, he's had Flintoff or Stokes or Moen Ali or Chris Wokes or Sam Curran. Mm. He's had five players in the bowling attack. And if you look traditionally, teams with really stacked bowling attacks, they don't take as many main bowlers don't take as many 5-wicket hauls. So Joel Garner is a really good example of that, right? And we've seen it all the way through. You know, Murali's 5-wicket hauls compared to Warne's 5-wicket hauls, right? Like, we know that these things happen. Mm. And yet, Broad doesn't just take 5-wicket hauls. He takes these explosive 6, 7, 8 wicket hauls that happen in an instant. Even though he's got Jimmy Anderson at the other end and he's got, you know, all these other bowling options around him. And someone asked me about this recently, and it was just in my mind. It was before he retired. I think someone might have asked on Wagon Wheel. And I was saying, I think what it is that because he's tall, because for a big part of his career he was fast, right? He's never expressed, but he was certainly at the top ends of fast medium, and he could get over 90 miles an hour. He could swing the ball both ways and also obviously move it a little bit off the seam as well. He was fairly accurate, but not deadly accurate. But I think a big part of it was that not everything always worked for him. And because he had so many different, if you actually compare him to Jimmy Anderson or Dale Steyn, you could argue he had more weapons than either of them, right? But they knew exactly what they were going to do almost every time the ball was in their hand. And if you look at Broad, sometimes it just didn't work. I don't know if it was a coordination thing. I don't know if it was a rhythm thing. Mm. I don't know if it was the fact that he didn't grow up a bowler as a kid. But when he got all of those things in a row, and they talked about his knees pumping, but when he hit that rhythm that he wanted to hit, that is the stage at which Stuart Broad goes from really good test match bowler to unplayable. And I do think he had that Curtly Ambrose level, maybe Glenn McGrath, which was his hero. But those sorts of guys, there was just a point, and I think it's something to do with the height as much as everything else, right? Mm. Of to be that skillful and that tall at the same time. You know, Mornay Morkel was a fantastic bowler. He has about 1/5 the amount of skill level that Stuart Broad did. In some ways, he was better than Stuart Broad because he was probably stronger and faster, but he didn't. He couldn't move the ball both ways. He couldn't do all those other little things that we see. And Kyle Jameson, who is a fantastic bowler, isn't quite the speed of Stuart Broad, right? And we're talking peak Stuart Broad, not 36-year-old Stuart Broad here. And so when Stuart Broad got all those things together, it was just incredible. And I think in some ways, to say that he was a big game performer actually undersells all the things that he could do really well. And I really wanted to focus on that because you don't get that many bowlers who can move the ball both ways, who can bowl at that pace, who have that height and have that accuracy all in one. And when that worked, I think that's why we got the sprees. And I was there at the Oval in 2009, and I didn't think he was a very good bowler coming into that. I think he'd taken a 5 or 6 maybe at Headingley, but the test was already over. And he always looked to me like a medium pacer who could bowl a little bit faster and didn't really know what he was doing, right? Medium pacer is maybe the wrong term, but like an all-rounder who didn't quite know what he was doing. And then you watch him in that spell, and I remember being square on, and I was just like, there was something about the velocity he was bowling and the way he could hit anyone on the front on the knee roll anytime he wanted. You were just like, this is an incredible creature when it all works. And trust me, I've seen Stuart Broad many, many times when it doesn't work in a way that you don't see with Jimmy Anderson or Pat Cummins or Dale Steyn. Those sorts of guys, they kind of are always good. Stuart Broad wasn't. Sometimes he was just flat and ordinary, and sometimes he was unplayable. He just, you know, vacillated between those two.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot that you've said over there that I want to touch on. First, I think it's actually amazing how he is that bowler who went for 6 sixes versus Yuvraj. You mentioned those Netherlands performances, and you also talked about that over versus Bumrah, which isn't like too long ago. It's quite recent if you look at the other things. And he's had these lows in his career, but then the highs have just been very, very high. And it's just been like, if it was a graph, it would be like that. So he's experienced both of those things. And I think that is what makes him special. Like, Stuart Broad is theater on and off the field. On the field when he's on song, of course, and off the field always. We'll remember him for that. And there are other nuances that you mentioned to his game, right? His height is like, you have to factor that in because his release points are quite high, you know, when you compare it to other bowlers in the game. Then he can swing it both ways. That's another big one. And he wasn't express quick, as you say, but he was still quick, right? All of these things added to his arsenal. He could move the ball both ways. But as you mentioned, he wasn't as consistent as, let's say, Courtney Walsh or Glenn McGrath, who were like similar bowlers to him, right? So that consistency, or lack of consistency, actually, do you think that perhaps it's the coordination thing, as you mentioned, or maybe, just maybe, because as you talked about it in your piece, Broad didn't start off as a baser. Yeah. He was a batter, right, till his late teens. So maybe that muscle memory wasn't as developed when he started off in international cricket, and he got better as he, you know, had gained more experience.
That goes back to the getting his legs up thing, right? I think that even when he bowled medium pace, and he was never not a bowler, right? But there's a difference between Glenn McGrath, who could only bowl, and Courtney Walsh, who could only bowl, right? Very similar high, tall bowlers, both very skillful, you know, different kinds of bowlers than Stuart Broad. In some ways, again, not as skillful. Like, neither of those were great swing bowlers in the way that Broad could be. But, you know, bowling, their off-cutters specifically, almost unplayable, both those bowlers, right? They kind of, you watch them, and you were watching someone who was completely in control of what they were doing at all times. Like, and those are two guys who like to bowl a lot, right? And I don't think Broad was that far off that. But you watch Broad sometimes, and there was a lack of energy. And I think, again, this goes back to a lot of his detractors would say he's not trying that hard. I don't think it was ever about trying hard for him. I think if you give Glenn McGrath or Courtney Walsh a cricket ball, and you say, we want you to hit the top of off, first ball, they're probably going to be pretty close. The amount of times I watched Stuart Broad start a spell, in fact, me, George Dobell always used to joke, oh, he's working his way back in. And there's a difference between McGrath and Walsh and Pollock. They very rarely work their, well, actually, Pollock does a little bit, but most of those other great bowlers don't work their way back in. So bowlers who struggle with line start wide, then they get a little bit closer, then they get a little bit closer, then eventually they're on the spot. Broad was one of those guys. And Courtney Walsh and Curtly Ambrose weren't. And if you look at them, they're the other two tall bowlers with the 500 wickets, right? And I don't think if you know, I know you're a little bit younger than me, so you wouldn't have seen much of Courtney Walsh, but you would have seen a fair bit of Glenn McGrath, I would have thought. There's no time that you ever watched Glenn McGrath and you thought, he's not in control here. Whereas you did sometimes watch Stuart Broad, and he overpitched, right? And he bowled short balls down the leg side, and he wasn't quite in control of it as much. So I'm only guessing here, based on how much I know about all-rounders, that even though he would have caught up, because, I mean, he's ended up bowling, what, 35,000 test match balls or whatever. When he was 15, when he was 12, when he was 15, when he was 18, he hadn't bowled anywhere near the amount of balls that Glenn McGrath, Courtney Walsh, maybe Curtly Ambrose, those sorts of guys would have bowled, because he had this other skill. Now, sadly for him, that other skill never quite developed. It was the bowling that developed for him. And so when he plays that, there was a comment on one of the pieces that said, oh, you know, because I said he played a lot of his early test matches because he's batting. And they were like, no, it's because of his dad. And I was like, no, it wasn't. They batted him at number 7 in a test match. They honestly thought he had more batting talent than he did. Partly, I would say him and Mornay Morkel are very similar here. They both can play the odd back foot cover drive. And I think in the old days, we used to think that meant that someone was good. Whereas in Mornay Morkel's case, it might have been the only shot he had. But I do think that there is something to not being as drilled in your bowling action. In fact, I'll pick someone else here, Tim Murta, right? Tim Murta, probably by the age of 20, say, right, had probably bowled something like 5 times as many deliveries as Stuart Broad. And other than the fact that Tim Murta, although he's pretty fit, to be fair to him, but other than the fact he's not as fit as he probably once was, right, he's probably more or less exactly the same bowler. And at the age of 15, Stuart Broad was bowling little floaty puff balls, right? And it's 17, 18 when he starts to bowl around 85 miles an hour. And then it's probably 19 to 20 when he starts bowling, you know, 92 miles an hour and those sorts of speeds. He is consistently changing all the way through, and he's a different kind of bowler all that way through. And I think if you go back, Glenn McGrath, Courtney Walsh, and you could put Curtly Ambrose in there, they find their length, and they're going to hit their length. And because they're tall, there's not a lot that you can do about it. Stuart Broad was never that kind of bowler. He never settled on one length. And I think part of it is because he thinks like a batter. I think the other thing is he's just not as well grooved as those top other bowlers were.
Yeah, and just from like an opposition perspective, you know, if you're facing Glenn McGrath, even late into his career, right? Regardless of the phase of the game, you're crapping your pants because you're like, oh my God, McGrath's going to get a breakthrough. But Stuart Broad, even though he, you know, when he is on song and is, you know, all hot and everything, he will blow the opposition away. But other times he will be bang average. You know, we've seen that Stuart Broad as well. So that's like the main distinction between him and someone like Glenn McGrath, even though Broad has more wickets. But here's an interesting one. Now, you mentioned in your piece that Stuart Broad has actually gotten dropped a fair bit, and that to between ages 26 and 34, which is kind of fishy because, you know, when you're an all-time great, you don't get dropped much, right? If you look at all of those bowlers who average below 25 or whatever, these guys will play pretty much every test match that they can unless they're injured. So expand on that thought for me a bit.
I think this is something I might have written about Harbhajan Singh back in the day, which was... Because when he retired from India, there was a bit of hype. I mean, look, he took over 400 wickets. As I said, he's a fantastic bowler. But there's a lot of people go, well, he's an all-time great. I'm like, is he? Like, he couldn't always get in his own side. Like, an all-time great is almost undroppable, right? And it is tougher for bowlers, especially for spinners, because you might only be fighting for one spot. And so if Anil Kumble or R. Ashwin is the other guy, you might be the second greatest spinner in the world and not get in the side. Ashwin doesn't always get in the side for Jadeja, right? Even though Ashwin's even a better bowler than Jadeja. So there is an element of that. And we'll get to it when Ashwin retires as well. But there's one...
That'll be a fun podcast. Yeah,
exactly.
That'll be a fun
podcast.
That's
one bowl, one spot. With Seam, you usually have two or three spots. So now you're going, he shouldn't be dropped as much. And the other thing is great batters don't get dropped a lot, right? So it is more confusing with bowlers. But if he was absolutely an all-time great, I just don't think England would have had any excuses to ever drop him, right? Resting, yes, you know. Maybe moving on towards the end of his career like they did with Jimmy in the West Indies. I could see that sort of thing, you know. That's fine. But would it, Australia had McGrath, Gillespie, and Brett Lee, right? It would have been really weird if Australia had gone into one test and go, I don't know if Glenn's feeling it now. We'll just go with McGrath. We'll just go with Gillespie and Lee. There would have been nothing wrong with that because, that you know, for periods of time, Gillespie was as good as McGrath and Brett Lee gave something completely different. Would have been, but what I just said is unthinkable. Right? It wasn't unthinkable for Stuart Broad to be dropped. Right? And there are different, sometimes you can be get penalised for having a really strong team and everything else, but you go through and he was dropped for Stephen Finn. You know, he was let go and dropped quite a bit in Asia because they didn't think he was a very good bowler in Asia. Again, some of these other guys who are all-time greats, they were great in Asia, right? Some of them didn't bowl in Asia. Like, we don't know if Dennis Lilley was ever going to work out Asia or not, but we've got a lot of data on a lot of these other bowlers who are fantastic in Asia, right? McGrath being one of them. Dale Steyn was obviously another one, right? Broad wasn't that. So he's not an all-surfaces bowler, which is part of the reason he's been dropped. I think the only thing that confuses, other than the fact he's a bowler and there are fewer spots, is the fact that there were certainly times when I thought he was dropped because they had all-round options and they were going in a slightly different way. Again, you're not going to drop Dale Steyn or Jimmy Anderson, though, right, in that situation. So I do think that you still have to factor all those things in when you're looking at it. And the other thing I would say is that the bar to be an all-time great is so high, right? It's so high. Like, if you looked at Kapil Dev's bowling figures, right? Forget his batting for a minute. Kapil Dev would struggle to be thought of as an all-time great, right? There are many, many players throughout the history of the game where you're just like, always close, but it's really, really hard. And I think that once you start to get dropped, you do bring in, I think, just that little bit of, okay, you know, if you're not an automatic member of this team. And when Broad was dropped, there was outcry, but there wasn't like, it wasn't like the end of the world. Because, but
I mean, Stuart Broad would make Stuart it look Broad like it did, was the end of the world.
But everyone else wasn't quite on that. And I think, again, if he was an automatic, you know, if you dropped Joe Root, right, after a run of low scores, everyone would be like, what are you doing? In fact, go back to when David Warner was dropped from the Sunrisers in the IPL, right? That had a bigger outcry in some ways than the Stuart Broad did, thing did. And that's because it just made absolutely no sense to drop David Warner. Whereas even Stuart Broad's biggest fans would be like, okay, I get it. I don't agree, but I get it. And I think that's another thing when I'm looking at someone who is all-time great. Like, you're looking for nitpicky reasons why they're not all-time great, right? Because not everyone could be on Mount Rushmore, or I suppose it's slightly bigger with cricket, but you know what I mean. Not everyone could be at that pinnacle, right? Yeah. It can't be. And it's subjective and it's nonsense, but that's kind of what we're doing here, right? That's what this whole podcast is, subjective nonsense. Yeah. And to be fair, so much of Stuart Broad's career was.
Well, I mean, I personally would like to think that getting dropped pissed Stuart Broad so much that he came back and, you know, made up for that lack of form just by, you know, trying to prove a point or whatever. But now let's talk a bit about longevity, because it's an interesting one, right? Like, both Broad and Jimmy have played the most number of test matches for Pacers in the history of the game. But then you have an argument that they play for England, and England play a bucket load of test matches. And if you look at the comparison charts, no other team comes close. Not even India and Australia come close, which is quite harrowing if you really think about it. And that said, even though England plays so much, Jimmy and Broad, well, we're talking about Broad, so we'll focus on him. He still has bowled all those overs, right? And recovered for them. So that workload management and longevity.
Yeah, I remember in 2018, Darren Goff saying to me that he'd bowled the same amount of first class overs as Jimmy Anderson, but he'd bowled 50% of his overs in first class cricket. Or maybe it was more than that, actually. And Jimmy had bowled, maybe he'd bowled 65% of first class cricket and 35 in tests. And Jimmy had bowled the opposite. And he was right. Mm-hmm. But by that age, Goffey was still finished and Anderson's had an extra 5 years. And by this point, I think, you know, Broad is probably bowled more overs than Goff as well. Different bowlers, of course. You know, Goffey was a proper Wacker Yunus type, throw your body, you know, through the crease type of bowler. They usually don't last as long. But regardless of that, I think there's a solid point there to be said for A, Anderson and Broad were specifically held for test match bowling, which allowed them to stretch their career out. But I remember talking, I don't know why I'm name dropping every England player here, but I remember talking to Swan about this once, and I said to him that the ECB at the time were exploiting their players, and that is why his elbow went. That is why Trotty's, psyche went. That is why Matt Pryor's Achilles went. All these guys were disappearing from that team that didn't need to disappear because they were playing so much cricket. And he was saying, yeah, but if I wasn't doing that, we'd still be playing a lot of counter cricket. And I said, yeah, when you're bowling counter cricket, what percent are you bowling? And he said, fair. True. And so when you hear the old stories about Courtney Walsh and Joel Garner and Glenn McGrath playing counter cricket and you ask them about it, they're like, yeah, we weren't trying particularly hard. We were running through the crease. You know, the famous Franklin Stevenson one where he started to bowl off spin because he realized how many overs he was going to be forced to play as a professional. So he started bowling off spin so he could prepare for his body. You can't do that in a test match, right? You can't suddenly go, hey guys, I'm just going to bowl 8 overs here, right? And so I think from that perspective, when Anderson and Broad are bowling at that top level, they are putting themselves through the maximum amount of effort. It's very rare that they are holding themselves back intentionally. Not only that, during their career, the ECB actually had monitors on them and could tell when they weren't trying as hard as possible. Mm. So they couldn't even fake it, right?
Wow.
And the other thing that they had to deal with that McGrath and Ambrose and Walsh shouldn't have to deal with is the speed gun, right? A lot of grounds in the world didn't have speed guns in those times. And you listen to old bowlers and they're like, we just took our foot off the pedal, give ourselves a break, and we come back for the big spell later on, or whatever it may be. You can't do that anymore either because someone starts to go, well, why is he bowling 76 miles an hour, right? So we know that they had to push it very hard. But you are right that the amount of test matches that they played is because they played for England. However, the amount of test matches that they played is also England kept them on the field, right? They took them away from white ball bowling. They did rest and rotate them. Again, Broad and Anderson didn't want to rest and rotate, right? They fought them to do all that sort of stuff.
Right.
The best sports science that we've ever seen, right, in cricket so far. You know, the IPL seems to eventually go past that. But at the moment, I think England certainly has the best sports science ever. They were really thinking about how to keep these two incredible players on the field. And they had to, not only did they have to deal with the most tests ever, back-to-backs didn't really exist before. Right, so these guys were going at 100% for 10 days out of 13 over and over again, right? So you have to credit all of that while also saying that there are many other bowlers who probably had very, very long careers who would have taken 600 wickets at a lower average than Broad probably, had they had the same advantages of playing as much test with all the sports science and everything else. But also, at the same time, you have to say there are a lot of other bowlers who would have died trying to do what Broad did.
One of the things I'm asked about most in cricket is the wobble ball. How do you pick it? What does it do? And does it exist at all? Well, one thing I can tell you is that wobble balls don't help when you're trying to groom your pubis area. For that, you want the seam-up precision of Manscaped. Their platinum package will ensure that your package will swing in the best way possible without the seam opening up. Their Lawnmower 4.0 will take care of anything out of shape, and then afterwards you can polish your balls with their moisturizer. Don't be dismissed by wobble balls this year. Go to manscaped.com and use the code REDINKA, all one word, to get your discount and put your balls in the best area you can.
NFL Sunday Ticket is now on YouTube and YouTube TV, which means that you can stay close to your team even if you don't live in their town. Like, maybe you're a Raven who married a Seahawk who got a job in the land of the Falcons. With NFL Sunday Ticket, you can watch your team's out-of-market Sunday afternoon games no matter where you live. Because you shouldn't have to change teams, even if you change towns. NFL Sunday Ticket, now on YouTube and YouTube TV. Go to youtube.com/presale to get $50 off.
Terms and embargoes apply. Offer ends 9/19. No refund. Subscription auto renews.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. That's fair. And I mean, sure, they were red ball specialists after 2015. But up until 2015, they were playing all formats, right? And they were pivotal parts of England's limited overs units as well. And, you know, we mentioned, or you mentioned in your piece that, you know, his workload wasn't as bad as maybe some of the other ones because, you know, Broad had a lot of help in that English team. And he still bowled a lot, but, you know, he wasn't overworked per se. But that brings in the career span conversation in all of this. And Broad's career lasted 16 years. That is a lot of years. And if you look at that chart of, you know, pacers and their career spans, he is what, in the top five, top six?
I think so, isn't he? Is he equal fifth?
Somewhere around that.
I think you're right.
He sits pretty high at in that list. So that is certainly worth some consideration.
Yeah, I think the guys in that list, I can't remember all of them. Imran Khan.
Yeah, I mean, Imran Khan is number one.
Years, isn't he? And Jimmy's 21.
Yeah. So
Imran Khan Jimmy. Right? Mm-hmm. And by the end of his career, he was not a frontline bowler anymore, right? Like, he was almost a frontline batter by the end of his career. Callis is at 17 or 18 years as well, I want to say. Another guy who could bat. Mm-hmm. And Callis has the lowest... Callis is almost not a seamer compared to these other guys, right? Just, you know, he bowled about 20 overs a game, whereas some of these other guys bowled 38 overs a game, right? I always say, you know, when modern players say to me, Callis is better than Sobers, and I was like, Sobers bowled 38 overs a game, or 36 overs a game, and Callis bowled 20. You've got to factor in how much people actually did. Kapil Dev's another one. I think he might have been the same as Broad. He might have been on 16 years as well. Again, could bat, right? To be just a seamer, which is what Broad was for the majority of his career outside those first, you know, 15 or 20 games, and to not be able to fall on your batting at the end of your career to get you in the side, right, is remarkable. And so I think from that perspective, it's a hugely long career. And even then, when I looked that up, I wasn't sure how long. I knew there hadn't been a lot of long bowlers, right? Remember that for a very long time, you had a sore back and you retired. And that sore back now was probably a fracture, right? Your foot got busted, right? Your ankles didn't work anymore. Your knees lost their cartilage. All these different things that happened for years. And bowlers just can't bowl anymore, mate. I've got a sore knee and all that sort of stuff. So I knew that bowlers had not had long careers, but even I was shocked to see that Stuart Broad was still, even on this metric, you know, in the upper echelons. And I think that you have to say that from that point of view, he was a fantastic, him and Anderson are unique athletes, right? In that kind of way. You know, Dale Steyn bowled faster than both of them. But Dale Steyn didn't bowl fast his whole career. He pulled it back a lot when he had to, and especially on helpful wickets. Dale Steyn was absolutely cooked by the end of his career. If Broad played in the next series, you'd say that was absolutely reasonable for England to pick him in the next series, right? And Anderson is like, what, 7 years older than Steyn was when he retired? It's remarkable what they are both doing. And I don't want to take that away from them, because I think what happens is we get someone who has, we judge everyone on their peaks, right? And I think that's fantastic. If you want to tell me that Lara is a better bat than Sachin, I think I probably agree with you on peak. But whose career would I take?
Mm.
Right? And when you have someone like Broad, if you know that you have someone who's going to average 27 and a half, 28, whatever his average is, over a 16-year period, that's it. Great. Tick. What an incredible advantage that is, because how many bowlers can you find that can actually average what he does, let alone for that period of time? And I really think that we need to reward players for wanting to do it, for being able to do it, for keeping themselves, you know, for looking after their bodies, or, you know, on all those sorts of different things that they do. Because it's not easy.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And of course, if you look at Broad and Jimmy, you know, they have 1,039 wickets between them. That is a lot of wickets that partnership
yielded. It's more than that, isn't it?
And just to look at, it is 1,039
as a partnership. Yeah, I mean, that's ridiculous. Yeah.
Just as a partnership. Yeah, of course they have, like, if you combine those numbers, then we go into the 1400s, right? It's going to be, 1300s, true. But anyway, let's talk about some negatives now, right? Stuart Broad's wickets per innings are less than two per innings. Now, that doesn't quite match up to the stature of bowler that Broad was. And also, his strike rate, even though he has this knack of going on wicket-taking sprees, isn't really great. It's in, what, the mid-50s, somewhere around there? So, yeah, how do you explain that?
This is one of where I felt... I'll do the strike rate first. I was a bit shocked that it was as bad as it was. I don't know if I'd never looked it up before or, you know, I mean, I've talked about strike rates in test cricket for bowlers before. And it was a bit shocking to me that someone who could go on a spree was also not that dominant a wicket taker consistently. And now, having gone back and thought about it, I'm like, yeah, of course he had a bad strike rate, because the amount of times he would bowl wide or bowl short to soak up pressure, it kind of makes sense. But it's interesting to have a reputation of being a spree wicket taker who actually took a long time to take your wickets. The wickets per innings one, I originally thought, okay, he's under two a game, but he would have had an all-rounder in a lot of these sides. But then when I went up the list, I saw a lot of those bowlers had an all-rounder in their side. Now, I think you've got Fazal Mahmood and Richard Hadley and Murali. You kind of take those guys out. But you should be averaging four wickets a test match. And again, I do think that one of the, and I've written about this before, but one of the real key things about Broad was, and Anderson, why England didn't win as many test matches as they should when they travel, is because neither of them took a lot of wickets away from home. So even when they would end up with very good bowling averages, it was very rare that those bowling averages would come with good strike rates. And so they might finish a tour with, like, I don't know, a full test tour of South Africa, right? And on that test tour, they might have 15 wickets, but an average of 27. And it's like, it's hard for you to say they didn't do very well, but they also, there's not a lot of impact in that. And I think that was, again, there's no England fan, even Stuart Broad would say that was probably the thing that he never quite mastered, was the ability to travel around the world and to take the same amount of wickets that he did in England at the same kind of rate that he did in England. And it's not always about the average, because quite a lot of these places he actually averaged okay. It really, when it comes to Broad, is more about the fact that he was very good at controlling the game overseas, but he wasn't very good at striking overseas, right? And I think that was, you can't, once you start to break that down, it is hard to argue that, again, that he's in that all-time great area, because that's really what separates you from, you know, the other players. Because there are a lot of bowlers who are really good in home conditions, right? How good are you when you travel away from home? And average, he was quite often okay, but he just wasn't this kind of strike force that he was at home.
Yeah, no, that's a very, very valid point. And we've inadvertently, I suppose, mentioned Jimmy Anderson a lot already in this podcast. Of course, why wouldn't we? Because he was Broad's partner. How much of a role do you think Broad's partnership with Jimmy played in his success and development? Because Jimmy learned the wobble ball, and by the time he'd perfected it around 2014, he gave that, you know, skill to Broad. And that is a very, very valuable addition in Broad's arsenal. Also, coupled with the fact that as time went on, both of these bowlers, they got better. They improved a lot with the passage of time. If you look at their performances, you know, before 2014 versus after 2014, it's quite a considerable dip.
So just to answer the Jimmy Anderson one, I think Jimmy Anderson and Stuart Broad are a very, very good partnership because I think they were very different the way they thought about bowling. And Jimmy Anderson thought about bowling very much like an old-fashioned bowler with a lot of skill, which is proper bowling coach material. You know, I was going to say you could see him in the nets with a big pot belly. Maybe you won't get a pot belly. He doesn't look like the sort of guy who's ever going to get fat, but let's see. Whereas Broady is probably more that sort of mad scientist of what about if we try this? What if we do that? In fact, I almost find it interesting that of the two, it was Anderson who worked out the wobble ball and not Broad, because you would have thought Broad would have just seen it in the nets and tried it. But Anderson's probably looking for small things, whereas what Broad was looking for was, you know, a knuckleball or, you know, something even more dramatic.
Well, very recently, you know, before this Ashes, he had worked out a new delivery for Marnus and Smith, and it worked versus Marnus, right?
Very shame-worn areas.
Oh, well, he at least marketed
it's all part of it, right? So look, I think they were very good for each other from that perspective. But I do believe very strongly that Broad's career would be looked at incredibly differently now if Anderson has not given him that wobble ball in 2014, because that is the point at where he goes from a very bog ordinary international bowler to a very fantastic bowler. And I don't think that you can make much of an argument when you have a look at the numbers. Like, it's he basically, you know, I've talked about the pace playing pandemic a lot, which is basically the bit where the wobble ball takes over, which is midway through 2017, towards the end of 2017. And then for the next 5 years, no one makes any runs in the world. Well, Broad has that dip starting in 2014. He has a three-year advantage on everyone else. And it's not like when 2017 and 2018 rolls around, he goes lower. He stays at roughly the same amount, you know, in that period as well. And so it is really, really obvious that he has a massive advantage by that delivery before everyone else in the world does. You still have to bowl it, right? You still have to master it. Yeah. Mitchell Stark was taught it in 2019 and took him 5 years, right? So I think I was just reading about this the other day about the knuckleball. Andrew Tai took 3 to 5 years, he thought, to master the knuckleball, whereas Benny Howe did it in a heartbeat, right? There are just different bowlers who work things out very, very differently. And that's not to say that Benny Howe's a genius and Andrew Tai is an idiot. It's just that it's harder. And so with Stuart Broad, still had to work it out, and then he had to be fantastic with it. And he did do those things, right? You cannot take that away from him. But I don't know, what would Pat Cummins have been like that when it was before he came back? What would Josh Hazlewood have been like if during his peak fitness years, if he'd have had the wobble ball, right? 5 years, because I think he got it in 2019. So imagine Hazlewood got it 5 years earlier, right? His average would be way lower than Broad's on tougher surfaces to bowl on, right? So I do think you have to factor all of those things in when you are looking at Broad's career again.
Yeah, and I mean, just the fact that he learned the wobble ball in 2014 and then, you know, before the pace playing pandemic, he actually mastered it and reaped the rewards. It tells you that Broad is a thinking and learning cricketer. Another thing that tells you that is that he was quite awful versus left-handers early on in his career. You look at that average versus Graham Smith and it's astronomical. It's over 200. It's absolutely ridiculous. But over the years, his average against left-handers got better. And this is, you know, it lays testament, I feel, to his greatness, because this is a guy who took 73 test matches to average under 30. You know, but then thereon, it just went below and below and below. And he ended up with, 27 points something. So, I mean, it has to come into the picture that Broad was someone who was using his brain a lot and actually, you know, upskilled throughout
the
length of his
career. Yeah, I think seems really interesting because he clearly didn't know what to do with them. And it's not rare, but it's not as common to be as bad against left-handers as he was. He took it to a level that most people don't take it to, right? And part of it was Graham Smith. If Graham Smith sensed a weakness, right? He was absolutely brilliant at capital. I mean, Graham Smith was not a particularly talented player naturally and yet willed himself, right? By looking for weaknesses in others. Of all the people I'd love to get on a podcast, you know, the guy who puts on his fridge at a young age, I'm going to be captain of South Africa, and then lives it. Mm. And basically, I don't know if you know the full Graham Smith story. I've written an old article about Graham Smith. It is worth us doing a footmarks on it because he literally...
We will, because the broken wrist is nothing.
Well. That's for his story. Yeah. The story about how he fucks over Sean Pollock to get the captaincy job because he didn't get a spot in the World Cup team would make Brendan McCullum blush, right? It is absolutely brilliant. Literally openly sledging the national team captain to get a position in the team. Absolutely bizarre. So he sees a weakness in Broad and he exploits it. And, you know, for a long time, I think Broad was, despite the fact he could sing the ball both ways, basically an outswing bowler. You look at that first spell at the Oval, not the first spell, but the spell that kind of, you know, propels him into the team. And he's essentially bowling outswing at that point, right? And, you know, you sort of go through him as a bowler a little bit and you work, and you know, at that stage, those sorts of bowlers do struggle against left-handers. And it was Goffey, actually, again, who I remember him saying to me, and this is before it was popular. So around 2018, and Goffey said to me that, I think if you check Stuart Broad, because I said something on air about Stuart Broad not being good against left-handers, and he said, I think if you check last couple of years, he's been really good against them. And Goffey was right. And I said, why? And he said, well, he used to have a perfect wrist for outswing, and his wrist has dropped a little bit. We now know what that was, right? That was the wobble ball. Right? We didn't know at the time that's what was happening. But that's why he changed. But when he did that, it wasn't just that the wobble ball started, because the wobble ball on its own is not particularly successful, like more successful against left-handers than right-handers, right? That doesn't make any sense. But what does Broad do? He actually then keeps the wrist in that position because he now believes that swinging the ball in is as good as swinging it away. That's probably from hanging around the England analysts and them saying to him, you don't need to bowl an outswinger. If you can bowl an in-swinger and you can wobble the ball, that's better. Mm. Then he goes, well, and again, I'm assuming this is analyst-driven, but Broad had to listen to it and had to perfect it. They start to tell him to come around the wicket to the left-handers, and he absolutely nails it because as this wrist is dropping, it means he's naturally swinging the ball away. And then once he doesn't come back in, then he's got the wobble ball when he doesn't need to worry about that. He goes from a terrible bowler against left-handers to one of the world's best. It didn't last. And it did against Warner. It didn't last as much against everyone else. He started to, because him and Kemar Roach got really good at it at the same time. Kemar kept his up. Kemar's still unplayable if you're a left-hander. No, that's not quite the case abroad. I think outside of guys like Warner, I do think most people kind of worked him out. But absolutely fantastic bowler against left-handers. And to go from being terrible at the start, it goes back to what you were saying. He averaged over 30 for 70 test matches. He kept upskilling his bowling. Most players probably don't do that at that level.
Yeah, well, anyone who was listening in on that, you guys are lucky to have witnessed this.
Yeah, you know, if you're listening on the podcast, you have no idea what I'm talking
from Jared Kimber, of course. And it's interesting, right? Like, I mean, if Sky is listening or someone from Sky, get Graham Smith, Stuart Broad and Zaheer Khan on the same show. I would love to watch that. That would be great. But it's interesting how, you know, we mentioned how Smith was amazing against Broad. There were quite a few other batters who really liked batting against him. And these guys weren't necessarily elite. Yep. Craig Brathwaite is another one of them. Now, I'm a big Brathwaite fan. I think he's one of the great dead batters of this time. But you don't think of him as elite. Yet his numbers versus Broad are amazing. Better than his numbers overall. And at the same time, you look at some of the all-time greats like Sachin, AB, Yunus Khan, Shivnarine Chanderpaul, and of course, David Warner.
Misbah, another one? Huh? Yeah, there's some good batters.
Yes, Misbah's on that as well. Yep. Yeah, David Warner, he absolutely dominated. That's quite fascinating because all of a sudden you have these middling batters who are okay with playing Broad and then these elite batters who absolutely hate chasing him.
Misbah, Yunus, Michael Clark, A.B. de Villiers, Chanderpaul. There's a pattern there. Hmm. And I think the pattern is middle order batters who probably don't want to face the new ball all that often. They've got past the opening bowlers and then Broad has come on. And because of his ability to move the ball and in both directions whenever he needed to, especially with the old Dukes, I think that for them, it was probably like them opening the batting at times. And I think there's a big part of that probably caused all those different guys some issues, right? I think that's probably fair. Whereas I think if you're Craig Brathwaite, it's not to say that Stuart Broad shouldn't have got Brathwaite out more. It's a weird record. You know, as you said, he averages more against Broad than he does against global cricket, which doesn't really make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
But I think if you look at Brathwaite, Brathwaite is set up to face opening bowlers. So I do think a lot of those guys who really struggled against, and I take Sachin and Warner are probably slightly different from that, but a lot of those other guys who really, really struggled against Broad probably prefer to play spin in the middle or seam bowling in the middle when it's not zipping around everywhere, right? And if you have a look, I think I'm right in saying this, that Rahul Dravid has a really good record against him. Is that right? Is Steve Smith another one? You're looking at the thing, does. So I'm trying to remember.
Of course.
Rahul Dravid, Steve Smith, Brathwaite. Is there anyone else? Elgar. Okay.
Elgar. Dean Elgar.
So there's four guys who are probably at their absolute best against the pace bowling and also when the ball is laterally moving, right? You nullify Broad if you have those skills. Whereas someone like Yunus, who's probably one of the best players of spin we've ever seen, someone like Chandrapal, probably one of the best dull pitch batters we've ever seen, right? AB de Villiers, you know, proper number four, number five, you know, wants just that little bit of shine off the ball and then he'll stroke you on the up through the covers all day, right? Slightly different when you've got Broad, who has multiple new ball skills. He's still going to get extra bounce when he comes back on for that second or third spell, right? So even if the pitch is a little bit flatter by that point, the ball's a little bit softer, you still got to worry about that extra bounce. Then you've got the fact that he does have the ability to move the ball. And if you're facing him with the Jukes, chances are, unless the ball has gone soft, he's going to be able to get some sort of lateral movement in. So I think it makes sense that that pattern exists. But it is interesting that that is what he dominated and not the top order players. So again, if you go back to Courtney Walsh and Glenn McGrath, who do they dominate? They dominate the top order players. And I did find that to me tells you that he was probably more in his element, you know, bowling against the middle order than he was against the top order. That's not a slight because you need those bowlers. You need, you know, that sort of stuff as well. Warner is probably the anomaly in all this, in that Warner, you know, but Warner had no problem with Broad for the first half of his career. It's just after Broad changed, Warner had no answers for it. And by that stage, it was maybe too late for Warner to change.
Yeah, no, that's fair. And it's interesting, right? Because Sachin averages, what, 13 against Broad, which is mind-blowing. But anyway, there's some more interesting factors that you mentioned in your piece. Now, from overs 40 to 80, you know, after 2014, Broad bowled 15% less than he had bowled in that phase previously because there were certain bowlers in his, or all-rounders in his team like Ben Stokes, who were preferred with that softer ball in that phase and expected to do the dirty work. So Broad didn't have to go through that. And of course, as you mentioned, he had access to the best analysts in cricket, pretty much. And also, for a large chunk of his career, he was bowling with the Duke's ball, which definitely helps. So how much of a role or factor do all of these things play in Broad's
success? So I think not having to bowl as much between overs 40 to 80 means he didn't have to bowl the dog spells, which he bowled early in his career, of just bowling short balls. I think there's a spell he does at Durham. Oh, maybe it's not the one at Durham. Maybe it's Ryan Harris who got those short. There's a spell he bowled in a series. It might have actually been in Durham, but against Sri Lanka or someone else, actually. I know I was in Durham. I distinctly remember Durham being
okay.
Where he has to come in and he has to bowl a long period of short bowling. And he was that guy, right? At times, you know, it wasn't going to be Jimmy. You know, Tim Bresnan and Chris Tremlett weren't really the sort of physical specimens to do that. So Broad, a period in his career, would come in and bowl the short spells when Stephen Finn wasn't playing. From 2014 onwards, he doesn't really have to do that anymore because that's Ben Stokes's thing for a long period of time, right? And again, I think that's a really, really important thing in increasing longevity. The other thing is the Duke's ball, right? So I was thinking about this with Courtney Walsh. Courtney Walsh is unquestionably a great, right? And you look at Courtney Walsh, though, and Courtney Walsh had to bowl with some of the balls that they used in the Caribbean, just terrible for bowlers, right? Some of the pitches he had to bowl in the Caribbean were absolutely terrible for bowlers, right? You know, flat, docile thing. I mean, it makes no sense thinking back to their attack. And occasionally they would juice them up, but they juiced them up less and less in Courtney Walsh's career than they had. Well, sorry, the second half of Courtney Walsh's career. If Courtney Walsh had played in England conditions for the same amount of time with that Duke's ball, I think he'd probably take 2.5 runs off his average, right? And there are a lot of bowlers. Glenn McGrath would have. I think Glenn McGrath's average in England was 18 or 19. And that was with Dukes and Reddings. He dominated with both the balls that were available to him. And I think there's a lot of guys who would have done that. That's not the case with Broad because he had that, right? He had the ability. And it's not the only one. Right. I think Mahela's career is a really, really interesting one. You know, there's a lot of players who are very good in specific sort of areas. I don't think I don't think that means that we turn on them or anything else. But again, we have to be honest. He had the best ball and the best pitches available for what he did over a long period of time. It's disingenuous to pretend that he didn't have that. In the same way, it would be disingenuous to say that Glenn McGrath was in the right place to be a tall bowler. Would Glenn McGrath have dominated in other places? Mm-hmm. Yes, because he did. Would Stuart Broad have dominated in other places? It's not as clear cut. I just think, again, you have to be honest with those sorts of things.
No, that makes complete sense. And I guess just to conclude this podcast now, all said and done, Stuart Broad is one of five bowlers in the history of Test cricket to take over 600 wickets, and only the second pacer alongside, of course, his good mate Jimmy Anderson. And, you know, his average and strike rate don't quite match up to the legendary pacers of yesteryear. So on a scale of one to all-time great, subjectively, of course, because this is all subjective, as you said earlier,
where would you put
Broady? I would say almost all-time great.
I think that's probably good. So, I mean, all-time great's probably a 10, right? Mm. Or at least a 9.5.
Yeah. I mean, let's think of all-time greats, right? Glenn McGrath, Wasim Akram, Hadley.
Dale Steyn.
Who else do we have? Steyn, for sure. Courtney Walsh, Kirtley Ambrose, those guys.
I had this up before because I was trying to see how much. If you just go through seamers. So, McGrath, Walsh, Steyn, Kapil Dev, Richard Hadley, Sean Pollock, Wasim Akram, Kirtley Ambrose. So the first bowler that I'd say he is better than on the list of the all-time wicket-takers is Intini. Right?
Okay.
Then you've got both of them an all-rounder, so it doesn't count. Malcolm Marshall was a better bowler than him. Wakar Yunus was a better bowler than him. The next one is Tim Southee, right? Again, on his level. I don't think anyone thinks of Intini or Southee as all-time GOATs. Now, he has 200 more wickets than those guys.
They definitely do not.
Right? You cannot discount that. Yeah. And I don't think you should discount that. Because he had to go out and earn every single one of those wickets. Right?
Mm-hmm.
However, then if they had 600 wickets each because they just played more test matches, no one would be putting them in all-time. They're both fantastic bowlers. Right? So I just want to see what was Intini. Intini's bowling average is 28.8. And Southee's is 28.
Also,
29.
Intini dropped time, right? Intini dropped big time towards the end of his career. Like he wasn't.
You would also say that he probably played too early. He wasn't ready when he first started, right? Southee, exactly the same. Although, to be fair, Broad is probably in that as well because it did take him a while to come good as well. But I don't think we would say that those are all time great bowlers. So are they 8.59 on the all time list? Yeah, you know, if Rahat Ali is a 2, right? It's probably unfair. Rahat's probably a 4. He's probably a 4.
Okay, that's fair. Ah, he's 4. I mean, he did bowl fairly well on those UAE tracks.
You know what
he
I mean,
one like, I'll give him
I wanted a bowler that's well-known enough, right? And I love Rahat, so of course I'm going to always mention him. But, you know, if they're a 4, then Southee is an 8, right? Or an 8.5 or a 9. And I think Broad is probably 8.5 to 9, but he's not Courtney Walsh, and he's not Glenn McGrath, and he's not Richard Hadley, and he's just not on that level of those, you know. And I remember talking to George Dobell about this. So George Dobell, I don't know if I'd asked him because I was writing the piece or whether it just came up, but we were talking about it, and George said something that is really, really, it's very illustrative of who he is. He said, "We should call him an all-time great because it takes absolutely nothing from us to include him in that list." Do you know what I mean? This man took 600 wickets, and it takes nothing away from from anything in cricket to say he's an all-time great. And then he paused and he went, but he's probably not an all-time great, is he? Right. And that, I think, is the fair way of looking at it. If you take 600 wickets, you definitely have to be in the conversation. And if someone wants to make, if someone wants to dive even deeper than I have and come out with it on the other side and go, he's definitely an all-time great, I'd be like, okay, that's fair. But I think I'm just on the other side of this subjective, nonsensical line that doesn't matter at all. And I'm just like, he was fantastic. What a performer for his country. He's absolutely, without doubt, an England great. But he's not an all-time great. And it, I, you know, it's just my opinion. And there are many other people that will have many different ones. But the more I went through it, the more that I thought there were just caveats on that. That doesn't mean it wasn't a fantastic career and that it wasn't absolute greatness within it at all times. He was, I still think, one of the most entertaining cricketers I've ever covered. Not quite on the maybe Shahid Afridi or Brendan McCullum level or Adam Gilchrist or Vrindar Sehwag level, but not far off those guys as well. And someone who was absolutely understood his place in everything and loved to just troll the world as many times as possible. You know, we can't overlook the fact that he's a child of privilege who went to a really good school, who is a Nepo baby and had all the advantages of English cricket at their absolute best of sports science. But the man still took 604 wickets, bowling seam. At a certain point, we just have to respect that.
Yeah, no, I think we absolutely do. And even though, you know, his dad was a cricketer, if you put Chris Broad alongside Stuart Broad, we all know who the better cricketer is. And I don't think we've had a lot of father-son duos in which the son is better than the father. I don't know, maybe we can talk about
you
this some
other day. You can't start a topic like that would make when you're closing with the podcast.
Yeah, no, but like you said, 600 plus wickets and 3,000 plus ones in 167 test matches, you can't really argue with those numbers. So yes, it may be subjective and all-time great or not, whatever he is to you. We can all agree that Stuart Broad was one hell of an entertaining cricketer. And when you were watching him, you could not, you know, ignore him. So on that note, cheers to you, Brody. This shot glass says Bahrain, which is as weird as your career. So on that note, we will end this podcast. And yeah, tune in once again next week. We'll be back with another episode of Footmarks. This is Behram Kazi, and with me was Jared Kimber. That's all for today. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are many other extras as well, including a Discord channel. There's a link to those in the show notes. Please review, subscribe, and tell all your friends about our show. Word of mouth is the best way of making our podcast grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bharat Sundaresan and Behram Kazi. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston. Each episode is produced by Ishit Kuberka at Sound Potion Studio. The team from 42 help us out with the video side. Orajoti Sainapayu and Maida Akam, both producing podcasts, while Mukunda Bandredi is the head of our YouTube content.
Sports Social Podcast Network.